WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
You're listening to Transmission Arts programming on WGXC.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Spike Priggin, host of the Bedazzled Radio Hour. Broadcast every week from 12:10 until 2 p.m. Wednesday afternoon, live from Spike's Record Rack, 400 Main Street in the village of Catskill. Every Wednesday, I play pop, rock, soul, country, blues, reggae, and other obscurities, and once in a while, a hit or two.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you're listening to me, your host. The name of the show is Midnight Northern, right here on WGXC. It's Monday, February 19th. I suppose that means it's a federal holiday. Banks are closed. Bankers are probably still making money. Which leads me to remind you that WGXC's fundraising drive is starting. I think as of today, maybe tomorrow. So, put a dollar or so aside every month. Every week even, every day, donate to WGXC, community radio, doing its alternative best. Go to the website and find out all the wonderful things that WGXC does. If I started to list them here, I would never show tonight. But if you and other people like you don't donate enough money to keep WGXC.org on the air, then not only will I not have a show tonight, but, well, you know what I mean. I'm not trying to be alarming. Station is in dire straits like that, but it ain't CNN or Fox News. I don't usually like to do a lot of political stuff, but then some of us say that everything is political. Since it's President's Day, I thought I'd remind you all that the real lesson is not that Hitler killed 6 million Jews in the concentration camps. Or even that he killed 14 million other Germans in the concentration camps who were not Jews. They were simply communist homosexuals. Other undesirables. That's not the lesson either. The actual lesson is that millions more, not only in Germany but around the world, took it all in stride. All right, enough of that. Lydia Davis has a brand new book out. Lydia Davis, one of the great short story writers of all time. I see here that Rick Moody says she's the best prose stylist in America. And James Wood, one of the pundits at the New Yorker, says he suspects the collected stories of Lydia Davis will in time be seen as one of the great strange American literary contributions, distinct and crookedly personal. Anyways, I think she writes her ass off. Her new collection out on I think it's on Penguin. What am I looking at here? No, it's just bookshop.org. It's the first book published by bookshop.org under the imprint Bookshop Editions, which wants to lead customers back to independent bookstores. I got my copy of Spotty Dog right here in Hudson. Okay, the first story is called On Sufferance. By Lydia Davis. The cat says, I'm only here on sufferance. The dog doesn't understand, so the cat defines the word sufferance. It has to do with a kind of tolerance. It has to do with permission that is only indirect, permission through failure to prohibit. She uses the word tacit. The dog doesn't understand tacit. Cat gives up. She thinks he probably got the idea anyway. The cat knows they love the dog and merely tolerate her. There's real enthusiasm when they greet the dog, when they come in the front door. She sits off in the background, watching, because the dog is so wild when he jumps on them. They see her in the background and they say, "Hello, kitty," but without much warmth. The dog is more demonstrative than she is. He wouldn't understand the word demonstrative, although he enacts it. He wouldn't understand the word enact. Later, the cat says to the dog, who stands below her in the kitchen, watching her and sniffing the air, "Now she has left the room, and I'm sitting up here within an inch of her chicken sandwich. That puts a strain on me." She reaches out a forepaw and touches the sandwich, but she is not comfortable. The dog likes her and is interested in her. Although he doesn't know the word strain, he would not find it a strain to be near the chicken sandwich. Then she says she has trouble with her salivary glands in certain situations and can't help opening and closing her mouth. Later, the cat is chewing on the broom again. The dog does not understand why she would do that. The cat says, she scolds me because I've been chewing on the broom. She leaves it out. I see it. Then she sees me chewing on it and comes and puts it away between the refrigerator and the wall where I can't get at it, though I try. I try when it seems to be where I can reach it. The dog listens to her explain all this. At least it is a change from going back to sleep again in that pool of sunlight, as he has been doing from time to time all morning, as it shifts across the floor. That was called On Sufferance by Lydia Davis. This one is called A Brief News Story from Long Ago by Lydia Davis from her new collection of stories out on Bookshop Editions from bookshop.org. Oh, I'm not supposed to plug other companies, but anyway, so I just did. It's called Our Strangers. That's the name of the book, the name of the story, A Brief News Story from Long Ago. We heard this story years ago on the evening news. A bride and groom on their wedding night did some heavy drinking with friends and then got into the bride's car and drove away. In a dead-end road near an overpass, they stopped the car, turned off the engine, and began to argue loudly. The argument was audible to the houses nearby and went on for so long that several neighbors began to listen. After a while, the groom shouted to his bride, "All right, run me over then." By now, the neighbors were also watching out their windows. He left the car, slamming the door behind him, and lay down in front of the front wheel on the passenger side. The bride started the car and drove the 4,000-pound vehicle over him. He died instantly. The marriage was only a few hours old. At the time of his death, he was still wearing his tuxedo. That's called A Brief News Story from Long Ago by Lydia Davis in her collection Our Strangers. This is called The Talk Artist. His literary form is the live talk, without notes, without script. After he has given them, these talks may be published. Now I'm reading a talk he has given in Philadelphia. The words are there on the page, and I hear him speaking them, though I don't know him or the sound of his voice. I am reading this in the bath, and even if I weren't in the bath, I would find there was a certain intimacy in reading something written by someone who cares about writing, especially a talk he once delivered in person. Then I'm at a party, and I see the author of the talk. He leans across several people to shake hands with me, clutching with his other hand the two lapels of his corduroy jacket and smiling with the friendliness of someone who has just arrived at a party, but not speaking. He doesn't speak, and all evening I am not within earshot of him, and don't see him speaking, so for me, for that part of the evening, he remains speechless. But back at home, the book still lies open over the rim of the bathtub, and in it, though a little less friendly than in person, a little more serious, he is speaking at great length and without interruption. That's called The Talk Artist by Lydia Davis. Here's another one. It's called Everyone Used to Cry. It is not easy to live in this world. Everyone is upset constantly by the large or even small things that go wrong. One is insulted by a friend, another is neglected by her family, yet another has a bad argument with his spouse or teenage child. Often people cry when they are unhappy. This is natural. For a year or so, when I was young, I worked in an office. Toward lunchtime, as the people in the office grew hungry and tired and irritable, they would begin to cry. My boss would give me a document to type, and I would push it away crossly. He would yell at me, "Type it." I would yell back, "I won't." He himself would become petulant on the phone and slam it into its cradle. By the time he was ready to leave for lunch, tears of frustration would be running down his cheeks. If an acquaintance stopped in at the office to take him to lunch, he would ignore that person and turn his back. Then that person's eyes, too, would well up with tears. After lunch, we all felt better, and the office was filled with its normal hum and bustle, people carrying folders and walking briskly here and there, sudden burst of laughter rising from cubicles, and work would go well until late in the afternoon. Then, as we all grew tired again, even more tired than in the morning and hungry again, we would begin crying again. Most of us actually continued to cry as we left the office. In the elevator, we would push one another aside. And on the walk to the subway, we would glare at the people coming towards us. On the stairs, descending into the subway, we would force our way down through the crowd coming up. It was summer. In those days, there was no air conditioning in the subway cars, and while the tears wet our cheeks, the sweat also ran down our faces, backs, and legs, and the women's feet swelled in their tight shoes, as we all stood packed together, swaying between stops. Some people, though they were crying when they got into the subway car, would gradually stop crying as they rode toward home, especially if they had found a seat. They would blink their damp eyelashes and begin contentedly biting on their knuckles as they read their newspapers and books, their eyes still shining. They might not cry again that day, not until the next day. I don't know, because I wasn't with them. I can only imagine. I myself would not usually cry at home, except at the table, if my supper was very disappointing, or close to bedtime, because I did not really want to go to bed, because I did not want to get up the next day and go to work. But maybe others did cry at home. Maybe, even all evening, depending on what they found there. That's a story called Everyone Used to Cry by Lydia Dickens. A collection, Our Strangers. Okay, this one seems to be, whatever. This one is called Addie and the Chili. It doesn't seem to be whatever. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I meant to dismiss my explanation, not the story I'm going to read called Addie and the Chili by Lydia Dickens. Years ago, Ellie asked me to write the story of our friend Addie and the Chili. The incident involved some bowls of chili, and more than one woman crying. In fact, several women crying, and also had something to do with our country's political mistakes, and the mistakes we ourselves make with our children. Addie and the Chili, I was going to call it, because sitting in the middle of the scene were three bowls of chili on the restaurant table, or rather two bowls and one cup. gave up. I don't know whether the story defeated me or I simply became distracted by other things. I was a single mother at the time and trying to support myself and my child. I was trying to write stories at the same time as I was working and caring for my child, and I often did not finish what I started. Now more than 30 years have gone by, and I'll give it another try. I ordered only a cup of chili, not a bowl, because I was upset and thought I would not be able to eat more. I was upset by the movie and by Addie. Addie ordered a bowl when she was still in a good mood, talking her head off before she knew what I was going to say to her. And then, after I said it, when the waiter set the bowl down in front of her, she could not eat any of the chili. Or at least, she said she could not. As for Ellie, she ordered a bowl because she was very hungry, despite being, like me, upset by the movie and by Addie. She finished her bowl quickly, though I didn't notice her eating. Maybe she was eating her chili while I was reproaching and insulting Addie, and Addie was reacting, too hungry to wait. Ellie then sat there still hungry, staring at Addie's untouched bowl. She told me later that she had wanted to ask Addie for it, but did not because she knew how offensive it would be to ask a woman in tears for her chili. What started the trouble was the movie Ellie and I saw earlier in the evening. It was a recently released movie about some devastating things that had happened in another part of the world that caused a great many children to suffer. Or rather, everyone suffered, old and young. But the movie showed the children especially, and it is always hard to accept the idea of children suffering at all. Things had also been happening in Ellie's life, and in my life, that made us more vulnerable than usual to such a film, although I can't remember now what those things were, and we came out of it exhausted by the sustained grief of the story. Others in the audience were clearly just as upset. Two men were evidently not able to leave the theater at all, and sat there, side by side, staring straight ahead at the empty screen. Women I saw in the line to use the ladies' room had been crying, or were still crying, or were trying not to cry. Then we walked from the movie theater to pick up Addie, where she was living nearby in a brownstone, and as soon as she came down the front stoop, she began talking about herself. Addie always talked mainly about herself, and she probably still does. I don't know her anymore, though not because of that evening. I try to think why Ellie and I remained friends with her. It must be that at times she did talk about other things and said intelligent things about subjects that Ellie and I were both interested in. As she began talking about herself on this night, she further upset me by addressing her remarks exclusively to Ellie, at least in the beginning. As I listened, I became very angry, though I kept quiet. I was angry at Addie for what she was saying, the way she was saying it, and what that told me about her life and her character. But there was more going on. There are other things feeding into my anger at Addie. I was angry at everything that had happened in the film, everything that had happened that day to me, and that week to me, and several things concerning my child, and several things concerning two friends who had attempted to commit suicide just the week before, and which I had heard about, in one case directly from the friend herself, how she had managed to call 911 and had been carried from her apartment on a stretcher. It had not been a good couple of weeks there in the dead of winter, and my anger at all of it boiled up in me when Addie began telling us something involving a lover, a story she clearly believed to be tragic and exciting, with herself at center stage, but that was, to me, and probably to Ellie, only dull and sordid. It is possible that on another evening, after a different couple of weeks and a different film, or even at a different time of year, in midsummer, out on the sidewalk, with a warm breeze blowing. I might have been interested in this story about an angry lover, phone calls at 3 and 4 in the morning, the offering of a bouquet of flowers, the bouquet torn from the vase and thrown in her face, the demand for a repayment of $50, the subsequent humiliation on the lover's part, his begging for forgiveness, and probably the forgiveness withheld. I remember everything but that last, whether Addie forgave him. One of the things he must have enjoyed about Addie, in fact, was her often absurd tales of love affairs. I remember only one longtime lover, or perhaps even husband, who used to cradle her feet in his lap and groom them, which I thought rather touching, and which did not fit with what was otherwise the style of her love life. But on this evening, as we walked toward the restaurant with a bitter wind blowing and slush at the curb, I was ready to give up on our plan to have dinner. I was ready to leave for home, though my small apartment would hardly have been inviting and would feel particularly empty since I had not planned to be there at that hour. I said I was tired and going home, but I was persuaded to stay, not only by Ellie, because she did not want to be alone with Addie, I'm sure, but also by Addie, no doubt, because she wanted more of an audience than Ellie. We went into the restaurant and sat down. As I began to read the menu, while Addie continued talking, I discovered that I was crying and did not want to eat or drink or talk. I made up my mind then to speak frankly, because I could not pretend that nothing was wrong. I then turned to Addie and told her that there was something I wanted to say. She looked me in the eye, and her expression was fiercer than I had expected, as though she knew in advance that something unpleasant was coming and had resolved not to listen to me. Before I could go on, however, the waiter came up to our table, a tall young man with chubby arms, and said, "What can I do for you, ladies?" That was when we ordered the chili, and the waiter did not seem very pleased. When he left, Addie looked at me again, and I went ahead, though I did not think that what I said would have much of an effect. I said I was offended by her. I was offended by the way she came out of her house and did not first ask us how we were and how the movie was, or even look carefully at us or think of us before she began to talk about herself and tell us her story. I said that she should try to read our mood and be sensitive to us, that she was so wrapped up in herself she hardly saw us, that she did not seem to care about us, but only saw us as an audience for her. Right away, she said she could not hear any more and began to cry. Then I saw that by her reaction, she had made me look mean, and that she had also held on to center stage, remained the star, though now in a different drama. Now I was yet another of the people who had wronged and hurt her. She said she was going to leave and took out money to pay for the chili. I don't know what I had imagined her reaction would be. Contrition, shame, apology. Ellie began trying to make peace between us. I too thought I would have to keep her there and let her tell her story sooner or later, or the evening would be spoiled anyway. I'm not sure that I would now feel the same way I did then, so it's hard for me to understand my reaction then. Now I would probably have let her go and written her off and spent the rest of the evening talking with Ellie. But in any case, I did what I could to mollify her, though I was annoyed doing it. I did what I could to get her back to her story and draw her out. It was not working. I did feel better now, though, having said what was on my mind, and I ate my cup of chili easily and was sorry I had not ordered a bowl. Then, because I was tired of trying to persuade Addie to talk, I turned to Ellie. We talked about trips we were both going to be taking soon, and then jobs that Ellie was having trouble getting, and then a certain man's opinion of her that she was worried about. She said that when she had nothing else to worry about, she worried about what this man thought of her. Meanwhile, Addie sat with her head bowed, dabbing at the surface of her chili with her spoon and sniffing. So then I turned to Addie again and persuaded her to tell us what had been happening that day with her lover, and she began to talk again. She talked about not only this lover, but about a gourmet cook she had picked up on the street and who had come to see her that morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. She talked then about another man, a busy screenplay writer who wrote her long letters, even though he lived right here in the city. During this, Ellie did not say a word. She had finished her chili. Maybe she was cross because she had not asked Addie for her chili and she was still hungry. She kept looking at Addie's chili. But I think she was also becoming truly angry herself now because Addie was doing just what she had wanted to do in the beginning, and what was really so offensive to both of us, talking her head off to a captive audience about the man who loved her. I will ask Ellie if there is more that she remembers. But after all, I see why the story was difficult to write. Most of all, because, as is true of many stories in real life, not much had happened. All that had happened was that certain emotions had shifted around from person to person over that hour or so. Addie started out cheerful, became angry and hurt, and then recovered her good cheer. I started out upset by the movie, became more upset and angry, and then felt better once I had spoken my mind to Addie, who was subsequently annoyed by her manipulation. Ellie started out upset by the movie, became angry at Adele, though not as angry as I was, recovered her equanimity in attempting to act as mediator in the conflict between me and Addie, and then in turn, once Addie recovered her good spirits and I attempted to placate her, became even angrier at Addie. But it is interesting in its own way to think what happens after a movie is made and people see the movie. A movie is made depicting how badly people are hurt in a war, and it is skillfully made so that it affects the people who see it. They cry or nearly cry or simply feel their grief and shame without showing it. And when the movie is over, they disperse, they go off in different directions, and some of them may have trouble eating then. And also, vent their emotions on their friends whose failings seem less forgivable after what is depicted in the movie. Now, I've asked Ellie, but she has forgotten the evening entirely and certainly does not remember asking me to write about it. It is strange that I was so sure she would never forget that evening. But prompted by my question, she thought hard and remembered Addie's full name, and then looked her up, which I had not done, and located her, now living in Europe. For me, Addie had dropped out of existence once I no longer knew her. Ellie discovered that Addie has even done some rather interesting things. Our lives go on, years pass, we start things and finish them, year by year. Things add up to our credit. Maybe that is why we were friends with her for as long as we were, not only because she and her stories amused us, but also because she had some interesting ambitions and was not unintelligent, besides also being so silly and self-absorbed. Though all three of us could be that, she was the silliest. As for what happened to Adele at Addie's chili, she asked the waiter if she could wrap it up for her so that she could take it home. We did not much like the waiter, in part because he clearly did not much like us, these three women arguing and crying who had ordered nothing more than some chili. He said the restaurant had no containers for that, as such, but that he would wrap it up for her the way it was, in the bowl, and asked her to bring the bowl back. She lived nearby. She could return the bowl the next day, and that is what Addie did That's called Addie and the Chili, from a collection of short stories called Our Strangers, recently published by Lydia Davis and Bookshop.org. Lydia Davis, I don't know if she's still around here. She used to work here for a long time. Not here, but I think more down like Barrytown, translating the likes of, I think, Maurice Blanchot and George Bataille, those weird writers that were popular back in the 80s, who were not quite postmodern, but adored by those people who thought that they adored the counter-revolutionary politics and aesthetics of the postmodernists. Anyways, but not that George Bataille, I don't think he was counter-revolutionary. He was probably actually a rebel. And Blanchot, too, he was good. I won't mention the postmodernists to rub me the wrong way. This one is called Tantrums by Lydia Davis. She's feeling out of control and uncomfortable in her body. She is pregnant. He becomes annoyed. You're always calling attention to yourself. I have a very tough weekend ahead of me. She agrees, but it is hard when she feels this way. She would like to just give up and go to bed, but she can't. She has to go on trying to make dinner. But as she lifts four pieces of chicken on one sheet of tinfoil, a piece drops to the floor. Damn you, she cries out to the chicken. Much later, when they're about to go to bed, yet another call comes from his brother, who is mentally ill. This brother has strange ideas about what they should all do together and also about carrying. He thinks that everyone must carry a mental potato with which to get on in life, and sometimes thinks he is a turtle carrying a loaf of bread under his arm. As often before, she has taken the call to protect her husband. This time, after she talks to him, she really begins bawling, pounds her fist on the wall. She can't stand his invasion into their life. She is furious, even though at other times she has been full of compassion. She knows the man is not responsible for what he says. Okay, here's the next story in Lydia Davis. It's not the next story in the collection, but it's the next story that I'm going to read. It's called Here in the Country. I guess we're more than halfway, Mark. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night, Norman. I hope you're on your way to snoozing out now that you've turned on and tuned in. Oh, to clarify also, this show is the first and third Mondays of the month. It is not every other week. I don't know. It seems like it should be, but I think there are about actually only three or four months in the year that have five Sundays instead of four. But it can be confusing because this is not every other week. So there will be times when it is every other week, because that's how the weeks work out. But more often than not, it's just the first and third Monday. Here in the Country by Lydia Davis. Here in the country, there are yards full of rusting cars kept for spare parts. A pale little girl sticks her fingers in her ears at the roar of a family engine. The same people appear at every store because here they all do their shopping on the same afternoon at the same stores. A raffle prize is a chainsaw, and this already seems desirable to us. All the neighbors have too much lettuce to use in their gardens, and so do we. Birds nest under the air conditioner and on the back porch inside a bamboo shade that we rolled up early in the spring to let more light into the bathroom. Bats spend a few days, maybe longer, behind the chimney. In the evening, we see them fly out one by one at short intervals, five or six of them, like carrier pigeons, starting off on a race. They dive in the air and fly low over the lawn. Later, they squeak by an upstairs window and scratch the wooden clapboards going in and out of the attic. Hornets have built a conical nest under the front porch eave. One evening at dusk, we knock it down. It is in layers, like fine pastry. There are tidy little homes with thriving gardens and lawns, perfectly smooth, dark green, and unblemished. Stiff, short, evergreen shrubs hug this tidy house, and one brown goose walks down the driveway followed by two white geese. But the people who come out of the house have a scowling, proprietary air, as stout and scruffy as old dogs. Sheets of plastic cover the windows of other houses, and the back porches are crowded with junk. Bees live in a hollow tree at the end of the driveway behind a black painted sheet of metal that was nailed over the hole long ago. In hot weather, more and more of them cling to the trunk by their hive, walking over one another until they have formed a thick golden beard on the tree. When the cooler weather comes again, the beard is gone. A black butterfly fans its wings slowly to dry them, riding on a leaf of palissandre. Powder blue spots line the lower edges of its wings and the undersides like a peacock's tail have iridescent eyes. At the back of our backyard, we hear the screams of the neighbor children and the clear, logical shouts of the mother. I'm giving you fair warning. Get off my back. On some days, mysterious vibrations shake the house as though some enormous person were throwing himself against the front door. On the way to the general store, we pass an overgrown lot with four tall poles forming a rectangle. Parked in the rectangle is a small, unused trailer. The neighbors' two dogs bark and bark. They may be barking at each other, but they may be barking together at some third thing. The hard-working old man two houses away from us cannot be idle. If he is not tending someone else's property, he rakes his own gravel or weeds his own vegetable garden. We hear the metal wheelbarrow rattling over his lawn. Sometimes he comes to the house next door to feed the cats on the side porch. Come on, kitty, kitty, he calls gently. Come on, kitty, kitty, you hungry? You hungry? That was Here in the Country, written by Lydia Davis. I was going to read this story, but I think it might be too long. I'm going to read this one. It's called Old Men Around Town by Lydia Davis. In our town, an old man used to come out of his house and take his daily walk along the sides of the streets. There were not many sidewalks, so he shared the street with the cars. But in the back streets, the cars went by slowly. He was a tall, thin old man with a slight stoop, the father of the doctor in town. He held his cane in one hand and a cloth bag in the other for the mail, and he walked briskly, but with such small steps that he did not advance very fast. He seems to be gone now. The warm weather has returned, but he does not appear on the streets. In the cold weather, there are no old men on the streets. Now that the warm weather has come, a few old men have appeared, but we see them only in the center of the town, walking a short distance along a sidewalk to enter a shop, or standing at a street crossing. One of them is fleshy and bearded in shorts and suspenders, dark socks, sturdy shoes. Another is bone thin and totters, swaying to one side, resting a hand against whatever bit of wall is nearby, or leaning far back to open a shop door. Another old man used to walk past our house. He had good balance and a longer step. He wore a tam o'shanter at an angle on his handsome head. His white beard was short and curly. He had lived in the town all his life, unlike the doctor's father, and he would stop to tell us where the sidewalks used to be and who had died a violent death in which house. We no longer see him these days. Yet another old man once a week would stand dressed in a suit and overcoat by his gate in polished formal shoes. He was out early, waiting to be picked up by his son. We see these old men on the streets of our town, and we see others in a nursing home where they have been left by their families. The nursing home is itself like a little town with its own chapel, barbershop, gift shop, and community meeting room like a town hall. There are the offices of the administrator, and there is the hallway like Main Street. There you may meet the others from the town and stop to talk with them. Some of the residents, though, spend the whole day going up and down the hall. They have given up stopping to chat, if they ever did, and as they pass you, they stare hard at you, almost with hostility, or else look straight ahead with vacant eyes. One of them, fine-featured, neatly dressed, who walks briskly with a vigorous step, mutters to himself about his men and what work they will be doing today. He stops to tell us that he must be up early in the morning to get down to the factory. The factory is gone, his men are gone, but he still seems to be in charge of something. A large-framed, tall, and bony old man still has all his wits about him. He sits in his wheelchair in the doorway to his room, facing out into the hall. And if we stop to talk to him, he tells us about his life as a wool sorter and grader in Australia. His wife visits him almost every day and spends many hours there, sitting in the chair next to him, their little dog on his lap, brightly observing the foot traffic and wheelchair traffic as it goes by. Lying in his white sheeted bed is another old man, the professor, with skin almost as white as his sheets. In a nearby bed lies his roommate, his skin dark brown. They are good friends and are affectionate with each other, though the roommate has more of his wits about him than the professor. The roommate enjoys his visits from his family, but does not like to leave his room. The old professor has lost a lot of his memory, though not his sense of humor. He tries to make a joke, but he does not speak clearly, and only his family can guess what he's saying. He knows who his visitors are, but he does not remember what he has done in his life. His family wheel him out of his room in his wheelchair and down the hall. At mealtimes, they take him to the dining room, where they help him to eat his food. In a village we have been reading about, 200 years ago, an old man would live out his days, whatever his condition, either in his own home or in the home of a relative or perhaps another person paid to look after him. He might be a burden to his family, or he might find small ways to help them. As long as he could get about under his own power, he might roam the streets or the fields, the meadows or the woods. Then one day he would be struck down by illness or accident and die slowly or quickly. Amiel Weeks, elderly though not yet near the end of his life, lived by himself on the south side of the village overlooking the sea and the woods. Every Saturday afternoon when the sun was still high, he would come in from his work, wash, shave, and eat his frugal supper of bread and milk. Then he would sit down to read his Bible. In this way, he began his Sabbath. Old Uncle Jonathan came to Mortis Posts. Old Uncle Jonathan came to Mortis Posts and set fence. The children thought no other man in the town could Mortis Posts. Then, when the sun approached the northern tropic, he would come again with his hoe to plant corn, and he would come again when the corn was up. The children would gather around Uncle Jonathan, for he had a kind gaze and a kind voice for children, and they liked to look on, hour after hour, when he mortised posts or spliced rails. He was tall and athletic and limp from rheumatism. He would stop work to take some refreshment regularly at 11 and again at 4 o'clock, when he would lay down his tools and have a little rum, saltfish, and crackers. His face was dignified with a high intellectual forehead, and his mind was probably equally intellectual, but he was modest in expressing his thoughts. Like others of that time, he lived in obscurity, poor, working for his daily bread, at last dying of old age, mourned for only a few days, and forgotten. Ebenezer Brooks, another old man in the same village, had prominent eyes, a large Roman nose, and a broad, sloping forehead. His hair was silvery white and hung down on either side of his spectacles as he sat leaning back in his chair by the side of the fireplace, reading the great Bible or sleeping over it in his quiet home. Old Uncle Eben was Ebenezer's son. In late middle age, a stroke deprived him of the use of one half of his body, and he became a heavy burden to his family. For 10 years, he sat in his chair or moved about by leaning on the top of it, shifting it forward, and leaning again on the top of it. He spoke in monosyllables, but never clearly enough to be understood. He would take up a pencil in his left hand and scratch a few words with it. He used to hobble over to his brother Obed's house, leaning on his chair back and hauling it along, resting often in the chair when he grew tired. He returned less and less often to his own house. At last he remained in Obed's house, sitting by the kitchen window, or on a plot of grass in warm weather, or standing in the woodshed in winter. There for many years, with his left hand, he would saw and split kindling. At last, he contracted an inflammation of the bowels and died. And then there was George Weeks, who would wander from place to place, restlessly all day long, returning to the home of the relative who looked after him only at nightfall, or when he was hungry or tired. One winter day, he had traveled farther from home than usual. It began to snow, and the east wind was blowing. The snowflakes fell on him more and more thickly. The storm and darkness gathered upon him when he was still far away from the fireside and the evening meal that was waiting for him. The nor'easter howled through the trees, and the snow encased their trunks and loaded down their branches and filled up all the sheltered spots in the landscape. Old George retraced his steps to the nearest house, but the only ones at home were children, and they were afraid to let him in. So he returned to the valley that he had to cross to reach home and descended into it, but he never reached the far side. His strength failed. A strange sleep came over him, and he lay still. The snow covered him deeply. Old Seth and old Joe were 80 years old and too feeble to work. Their wives no longer spun wool or wove their own cloth. So the old man made an arrangement with Obed Brooks, proprietor of the general store. They deeded him some of their property, and in exchange he supplied them with groceries and coarse broadcloth to keep them decent and warm. It then became a common sight in the village. Old Seth and old Joe coming up slowly along the Brewster Road with a wheelbarrow, taking turns, wheeling it. In the wheelbarrow, they would carry home their pork and molasses, stopping now and then to talk to someone they met along the road, and then walking on, chattering away together like two children. It looks like I have about two or three more minutes. Probably long enough. I was going to read Our Strangers, the title story. But that's too long. I'm not going to read that title story. I'm going to read a story called Her Selfishness. You've been listening to me, Norman Douglas, the name of the show. Good night, Norman. Tune in again in 2 weeks for another round. Her Selfishness by Lydia Davis. Her selfishness kept reappearing in many different forms. She would recognize it in one form, attack it, think she knew her enemy. Then, as she was occupied with struggling against it, it would reappear in another form, or rather, she would recognize it in the form of something that had been so familiar to her, so constantly there, that she had never suspected that it, too, was a form of selfishness. Oh, she would then say, so that is also selfishness. Was it like a cancer? Just like. Because as she was fighting it in one spot with all her weapons, she would recognize it in another spot. And as she was fighting it in that spot, she would see it in another. It was everywhere.